Now, as the nation grapples with an ongoing opioid crisis, there are plenty of questions to be answered as to how we got here and what the lasting impact might be on communities, our country, even our economy. That last point is where our next guest comes in. In a new report, he lays out the economic costs of the ongoing opioid epidemic. The report finds that the economic costs have exceeded $1 trillion from 2001 to 2017, and that dollar figure could grow significantly higher by 2020 if no action is taken. Corey Ryan is a senior analyst with Alterum's Sustainable Health Spending Strategies program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. Corey, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Corey, we've heard a lot of different stories and angles on this opioid problem. Why was it important to try to calculate this economic hit that we're taking from it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important perspective for us to get to take, because what we believe is that you really can't solve a problem until you understand it. And so what we're really trying to do here is we're trying to parse out not only what the total burden is of this epidemic, but also where those costs are coming from, and then where they're falling. And so by doing this analysis, what we find is that productivity losses and healthcare costs are the primary drivers of the opioid epidemic, and the burden that that is placing on individuals, the private sector, and federal, state, and local governments. And so what we see is that those costs are occurring both from fatal overdoses and also from those that are suffering from substance use disorders. And so the combination of those impacts, in 2016, we found an estimate of over $95 billion. And as you mentioned, when we look over the time period from 2001 all the way through 2017, we're talking about $1 trillion in total economic impacts. And then projecting forward, if we see the current rates that we've observed in the past couple of years, we're predicting a potential of an additional $500 billion in total economic costs. And so those burdens are really important for us to try and capture and really try to wrap our arms around the scope and scale of this problem.
Before we dig deeper into what's behind those costs, anything we do about the opioid epidemic, a lot of it looks expensive on paper. When you stack it up, though, against the cost that you're seeing, does it give a little more impetus to take action?
Absolutely. When you're looking at the scale of the burden that we're showing here, I would agree that certainly offering full treatment and recovery services to individuals can be expensive, but it's something that when you're bringing people from a substance use disorder and back to a productive lifestyle and back to being employed and back to being full members of society, it certainly has the potential to be cost-saving. And I think that's a really important message to show. And although we haven't in this work thus far been able to show what the particular intervention kind of cost-benefit outcomes might be, when you look at the total burden that we're seeing, there's a great potential to see cost savings by making policy improvements.
You mentioned a big part of that $1 trillion cost from the opioid epidemic comes from fatalities, from people dying often of overdoses. Can you talk about, obviously outside the human cost, can you talk about how that affects the economy as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at 2016, the CDC estimates over 42,000 deaths across the United States as a result of opioid fatal overdoses. And what is really striking about those deaths is that over time we've actually seen that the average age of those fatalities has gone down, which indicates that we're losing people right in the prime of their life. These are when they have young families. These are when they're expected to be employed and expected to be earning wages. And so by then trying to look, okay, what is the impact that this individual would have had they not suffered that overdose, had they not been addicted to opioids originally, and what would their life course have looked like? And they would have been earning income, they would have been supporting a family, they would have been paying taxes both at the federal, state, and local level, and that's really where the bulk of these economic costs are coming from.
Talking to Corey Ryan from the group Alterum, and he's with the Sustainable Health Spending Strategies program, talking about a new report on the costs, the economic costs of the opioid epidemic, $1 trillion over the last 16 years or so in costs, that report finds. And Corey, another aspect that you mentioned, healthcare, rising, increased healthcare costs due to opioid addiction. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there are two main components that we capture in this report, and in some ways they're just kind of the floor of what the potential healthcare costs might be. So the first component is healthcare costs associated with overdoses, and so that's primarily individuals that are going to the emergency room as a result of an overdose. They're getting treated, they're getting saved, and then they're also potentially then being hospitalized as well as a result of those overdoses. So that's one component. The second component are what we call indirect healthcare costs. So this is the indirect risk of being a opioid user, that puts you at risk for other diseases. So those that use opioids, and particularly those that use illicit drugs, are at a greater risk for HIV and hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and also just makes treating their other medical conditions so much more complicated if they're also suffering from a substance use disorder. And those costs are borne both by private insurance, by Medicaid, and by Medicare. So it's relatively evenly split across those payers.
Something we've heard anecdotally here, I don't know how widespread this is, but we hear in Wisconsin that employers sometimes have a hard time finding employees who can pass drug tests, in part because of opioid use. Is that part of the cost you see?
That's absolutely a major issue. It is something that is captured here. Because of the way that we measure the economic costs, the combination of individual costs and employer costs are rolled together as lost potential wages, because those are benefits that are kind of combined to both the individual and what they're getting paid, but then also the productivity that they're offering to their employer. But that story is something that we have also heard across the country, and certainly makes it difficult for employers to expand, and is extremely frustrating when they're looking to, in this in some ways booming economy, to try and expand their reach, and they can't find the people they need to make that happen.
When you pull this all together and get that $1 trillion figure, and as you say, another maybe $500 billion in the coming years, those are big numbers. But you know, it might take the form of this county over here is having to pay more for Narcan and emergency response personnel, and the economy as a whole is taking a hit, but you might not feel it individually. Are these costs so dispersed that it's hard to realize how big a deal it is all at once?
So the costs certainly are not evenly distributed across the country. We know that there are hotspots both of users and also of deaths, and certainly of direct impacts on the private sector. So that is certainly an issue. And you're right. I think part of the problem when you're trying to marshal resources towards solving this problem is that it's not just the federal government that's bearing this cost burden. It's not just state and local governments. And it's not just the private sector. So it's really hard to find that one key investor that's willing to put all the necessary funds forward in order to solve this problem, because so many diverse groups are being impacted. And so as much as we can get groups to realize that they need to be able to pool their resources and work together to solve this problem, that's going to be our most effective strategy to finding solutions.
We're talking about the economic costs of the nation's opioid crisis. Our guest is Corey Ryan, senior analyst with Alterum's Sustainable Health Spending Strategies program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. Their new report there says, hey, the economic costs, $1 trillion since 2001, 2001 to 2017. More expenses to come if this goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the opioid epidemic taken a toll on your town, your city, your local government, your local economy? How do you see that playing out? If you are in local government, are you seeing rising costs related to opioid addiction, to heroin overdose? What do you think governments can do to try to rein in the costs? And if you're an employer, are you in that situation where you need somebody who can pass that drug test, you're having a hard time finding them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We'll go to a caller. James is on the line in Appleton. James, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Great topic you have going on here. I was just calling to say that I work in the health field in the Fox Valley area in an ER, and I see on, you know, a weekly basis, sometimes day to day, the problems with opioid abuse that can happen and how much it's costing everyone involved. And I was just wondering, you know, you did this research, you have these numbers for the opioid abuse from 2001 to 2017. I was wondering, with all across the country how states are decriminalizing marijuana, I was wondering if you had any numbers against what that is, so we could kind of quench the viewpoints on people to say that that's just as bad as the opioid abuse is happening. And I could take my response up here.
James, thanks for the call. Corey, I know this report focused on opioids. I don't know if you have anything comparable on marijuana. Throw that in if you do. But to start with this point about seeing this in ERs, that is a big part of the cost here, right?
Yes, absolutely it is. That certainly is the most direct way that individuals that suffer from overdoses get pulled into the healthcare system. And unfortunately, that's often a point that it's far too late for us to be intervening. It would be far better to encourage prevention and treatment efforts before those overdoses occur and before the fatalities occur, because that's a much more cost-effective way to solve this problem. And it takes a wide variety of stakeholders to be engaged in those activities. It's both looking to employers, it's looking to leaders within the communities to really engage individuals in preventing opioid use as much as possible. And certainly that also means turning to looking at the medical community and certainly improving prescribing practices and limiting the number of opioids that are going towards treating chronic pain, which we know is not a successful strategy.
And that takes us into some of the recommendations in your report. I know you mentioned you didn't do kind of cost benefit of the different solutions here, but what kind of recommendations are you coming out of this report with?
Right. Yes. So I think looking at particular interventions and strategies is certainly something that we want to do down the road. And this is really the first step to saying, okay, what might the cost-benefit analysis be of a certain program? And once we have a better understanding of what options are being employed and we have better data that comes from around the country as these interventions are being put into place, we should be able to develop some of that work. But the recommendations that we're making right now really are revolving around three different categories. One, as I talked about, is efforts to prevent opioid addiction before it happens. And some of that is involved with certainly interventions that need to be done in the community, law enforcement strategies to get illicit drugs off the streets as much as possible. But it takes so much more than that to solve this problem. And really, we need to look to the medical community to improve how we treat chronic pain, offering alternatives to individuals, and doing a better job of cutting down on unnecessary opioid prescriptions. So that's preventing the unnecessary substance use on the front end. But then we also need to take advantage of the opportunities to treat those that are suffering from a substance use disorder. And so what that really means is that it's getting them into detox services, getting them medication-assisted treatment as early as possible, and then also engaging them for long-term steps towards recovery. And that really means engaging an individual through a long-term plan, because we know that it's not just a two-week detox program that's going to get somebody through their opioid addiction. It's going to be a long-term combination of resources that they need over a long period of time to get them to recovery.
I want to bring on another caller now. Vince is with us in Milwaukee. Vince, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to tell us about
this? I'm a heroin addict. I've been through treatment multiple times. I tried the Suboxone, which kept me clean until my insurance ran out and I was no longer to get my prescription anymore, because I couldn't pay for it. And I tried also an inpatient treatment center two times, which the first time worked out. I stayed clean for about 12 months. The second time I got kicked out for using about a month into it. I overdosed one time, and in my vehicle, the paramedics came and gave me Narcan, and then took me to the hospital, which I wasn't able to pay my hospital bill either. I didn't have any money. So I'm trying to actually get into methadone treatment right now. I called 2 days back, and they said that they should be calling me back after they screen my background. So I'm hoping that this will work.
Vince, thank you for sharing your story. Good luck to you. Keep plugging away, and I hope you find a good treatment that works for you. Corey, talk about this. He ended one of his treatments because he couldn't afford it anymore. Looking at your report and the costs, is that a case to be made for? It would have been worth it to keep Vince to pay for Vince's treatment and not deal with the other problems down the road.
Yes, absolutely. When patients have something that's working for them, taking it away from them can certainly lead to bad outcomes, and that's absolutely something that we want to prevent. And again, like I've said, it takes partnerships with many stakeholders in order to make that happen, because it's not always going to be one provider or one source of funds that's going to make that happen. But as much as we can keep folks like that are on a path towards success moving in that direction, that's really what we want to try and promote.
Vince, again, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. Corey, briefly, as we wrap up, I assume this report you're hoping is a wake-up call. Do you see people responding in that way?
Yes, absolutely. I think, as I said, you know, the goal of doing this type of work is trying to understand the problem, but also absolutely try to draw attention to it and try to marshal resources towards it, because this is a problem that's going to take funds, and it's going to take investments in prevention and treatment services to cut down on the number of deaths, which we still see rising through 2017. And we don't have 2018 data yet, but every indication is that this problem is still getting worse, and unless if we can get the resources that we need to start and chip away, this problem is going to get worse. So hopefully it draws attention and hopefully it starts getting people thinking about what we can do about it.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Corey Ryan, Senior Analyst with Alterum's Sustainable Health Spending Strategies Program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. He just joined us to talk about the group's new report on the economic cost of the nation's opioid crisis. A bill has passed the Wisconsin State Assembly that sets minimum safety standards for old barns that have been repurposed to hold weddings and other events. But as Glenn Moberg reports, some local officials worry that the new state regulations won't go far enough.
The wedding barn bill was introduced by State Representative Travis Tranel, a Republican dairy farmer from southwestern Wisconsin. He says his bill focuses on safety.
Proper egress, you can't have open flames within the building, no smoking within the building, fire alarms, the flashing ones, so everyone is aware if there is an incident. Everything has to be to the current electrical code. The plumbing all has to be up to code.
Tranel says uniform standards are necessary for a growing industry.
Ag tourism is definitely a growing thing. People are looking for any and all excuses that they can to get out and enjoy rural Wisconsin.
Imagine having your wedding and reception in one of Wisconsin's most unique settings.
The wedding barn business is booming. From high-profile sites like Old World Wisconsin, managed by the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Within our centerpiece facility, the Clausing Barn.
To rustic, unregulated old barns owned by family entrepreneurs. State Representative Katrina Shankland, a Democrat from Stevens Point, says she supports Tranel's bill, but thinks it could be improved.
It seems like the laws haven't been keeping up with the growing trend toward agritourism, and I'm very supportive of agritourism. I think it helps people in rural communities with economic development, but I do think we also need to balance those needs with safety.
So we need your help, Katrina. Well,
Shankland spoke at a meeting on safety that drew rural town and county leaders to a wedding barn owned by John Aaron, the head of the Portage County Farm Bureau.
We want to make sure they're safe.
Aaron says he put $500,000 into his barn, including safety features that go above and beyond what's required by Tranel's bill. His backup lights and generator made a difference during a wedding reception in August after a semi-truck hit a freight train in Stevens Point.
And all of a sudden the power went out everywhere in the barn. All the neighbors were completely dark. Instantly all the backup emergency lighting kicked on. People were still going in and out of the bathrooms. The emergency backup generator fired up.
Aaron says backup lighting and generators should be required.
I look at what would have happened. You know, everybody has some alcohol and all of a sudden it's completely black in here. Somebody's going to trip down a stairs, or worse yet, get trampled.
We get the government we deserve.
Aaron invited Nancy Mistel, the director of Wisconsin's Office of Business Development, to tell the local officials what they could and couldn't do. She said they need to accommodate the wedding barn business when they can.
If you're a town that simply says, ain't going to happen here, and if you do it, we're going to fine you $500 every time you do it, I've got people that just consider that a cost of doing business.
Trucks are going up and down the road, squealing their tires.
The town leaders had concerns about too much noise in residential neighborhoods, parking on the highway, and safety. Barry Jakowski is the Portage County Planning and Zoning Committee Chair.
I would hate to have friends or my family members go to something like a wedding or an anniversary that is supposed to be a very joyous occasion and lose the whole family because the barn went up in flames.
Leif Erickson, a Town of Eau Plaine supervisor, said some barns could collapse.
And I worry about having dances in these buildings because they're not built for that. They're built for dead weight. Hay, grain, whatever, that's what they're built for. They're not designed or built for moving weight.
Erickson said some barn owners hold weddings without getting permits. He said they ignore safety regulations and then claim that their events are private and only for friends and family.
People have barns and have a barn dance once a year. That's not a problem. But when when people are generating income and avoiding taxes, that's what bothers me more than anything else.
Nancy Mistel says there are things town and county officials can do. They have the power to issue temporary seasonal permits for wedding barns and set conditions for them.
My advice is sit down, work with people, and see what you can come up with, because two heads working together are probably going to come to solutions.
The wedding barn bill has not yet passed the Wisconsin State Senate. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at proposed changes to food stamps in the president's budget released earlier this week. Those plans include a move towards sending a box of selected food items to replace some of the financial assistance. We'll get the details and ask what you think about the idea. We'll explore the weird economics of ticket sales for concerts and sporting events. Our guest economist says, hey, a lot of those tickets are underpriced, even though they may seem pretty expensive. And on Food Friday, our own Lori Skelton is back with us for some great advice and new twists on making delicious soup to keep us warm for the last weeks of winter. You can share your favorite soups. What do you like to make? What do you like to eat? And any questions you have on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.